Hi everybody, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests, for some strange reason. In the studio with me today, one of my favorite people, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent Robert Shaw is a psychiatrist, works across the street, works with us a great deal, and knows a lot about addiction and drug abuse and things like that. So I've asked Kent to come in because I've been intrigued by some of the latest findings with alcohol. And I know you're the guy to talk to about it. What's the latest thing we learn about the sudden withdrawal syndrome that people have talked about, Kent? Let's talk about that. Let's start with laying the groundwork for it.
Well, again, when you become dependent on alcohol, meaning when you drink heavily day after day, your body becomes used to alcohol and it goes through biological changes, your brain, as it becomes more and more tolerant of the alcohol, meaning that over time it loses its effectiveness. And so as you become more tolerant, you need to drink more alcohol to get the same effect. And for that reason, you become more and more need a higher amount of alcohol every day.
But what's really going on? You're getting pickled? I mean, what happened? What's really going on that makes you want, what makes you decrease your tolerance or increase your tolerance? What goes on? What goes on chemically? Why can't the same amount of alcohol satisfy me every time?
Well, because that's the nature of a fair amount of chemicals that are abused, whether it be, you know, heroin or cocaine or alcohol. These chemicals have a property that over time, the brain is not stupid. The brain likes homeostasis. And so it likes to stay normal, like a thermostat, so that every night or every day that you have this exposure to these chemicals from the outside that causes change in behavior and change in brain chemistry, the brain starts to adapt over time. It's analogous, I say to people, that if I were to scream at you every day, that meaning like an excessive amount of chemicals, what you would do over time is put on earmuffs because you wouldn't want to have me blasting screaming at you every day. So that it would feel more normal. And that's analogous to what the brain does. Over time, it makes adaptations to normalize itself so that every night you're not having an excessive tiredness or sleepy feeling with alcohol. You're starting to just feel normal with it.
But it doesn't happen with all of them, Kent. I mean, like if I take a vitamin C drink, it's a chemical. You know, and that's a chemical that I don't seem to be raising tolerance to, and I have to have more and more. Is it because the thing has such a dramatic impact on us?
That's correct. That's correct. It's because it affects the behavior and it affects the nervous system so profoundly that the nervous system over time will try to adapt itself because the nervous system doesn't like, from the way the brain sees it, an assault or an over amount of chemicals that are produced by externally adding something by drinking or smoking, chemicals that are only in the body a certain level. So the body becomes used to a certain higher amount, and in order to achieve the same amount of intoxication or euphoria with a chemical, you need to go higher amounts, and this is known as tolerance.
How does this relate to cortisol?
Well,
because that's where the latest findings are about the effect of cortisol in both addiction and withdrawal.
Right, because over time, as you're drinking heavily over time daily, what happens is that every day you then in the mornings go through alcohol withdrawal. And what happens with alcohol withdrawal is the opposite effect of what happens when you're intoxicating, meaning that what comes along with all these drugs, along with tolerance, which is a greater amount to need the substance over time to get the same effect, the dark side that comes along with that is that if you don't have the substance, you go through withdrawal, which is an uncomfortable sensation because the nervous system is feeling a lack of something. So what happens is the body then reacts to the absence of the alcohol in the morning and starts going into a kind of reaction like rats or human beings are supposed to have genetically with fight or flight. A fight or flight reaction, which is a normal, healthy response to stress, is for the body to release certain hormones to deal with the stress. And they would be things like cortisol and adrenaline. So the adrenal glands produce both of those. And again, it's a
okay,
normal.
We don't know. So let's slow that down. We have adrenal glands. You said the adrenal glands. Is it somebody else's adrenal glands? Everybody has adrenal glands. Right. And under stress, everybody will secrete cortisol and adrenaline.
That's right. And that's
alcohol has a specific relationship to cortisol because almost everybody who is high alcohol dependent has high levels of cortisol.
That's right.
And we don't know why, but we do have this correlation.
Right.
We think that it's because they have an alcohol withdrawal.
That's right.
The one thing we know is that there is an increase in cortisol.
That's right.
Now, there's an increase in cortisol when you're drinking. One of the dangers is if you take away the alcohol, what happens related to this cortisol?
Well, then the cortisol, which increases during stress, goes through the roof, meaning that if you're drinking every day because you're going through withdrawal, you're actually calming yourself down when you start drinking. If you suddenly stop drinking when you're highly dependent on alcohol, then the stress reaction continues sometimes to a dangerous level. So the cortisol levels, which are already high, then become even more severely high and disrupt people's ability to think clearly and to think straight. So
when
it's
you
actually,
when you see people who are very stressed out, very stressed, they're screaming and they're nervous and they're worried, you could say to yourself as a psychiatrist looking at them, high cortisol levels.
That's right.
Then if you see super cortisol levels, super stress, like somebody who's not drinking when they drink every day, and you see this nervousness, it almost looks like they're going to blow their mind, you know? It almost looks like their brain's going to explode. And the truth of it is, that's not so far from the truth.
Right.
That when you have a cortisol in increasing levels, what could happen to you? I mean, could you, don't you pass out? What happens?
Well, many horrible things happen when you stop drinking suddenly. If you become fairly dependent, drinking heavily every day, you can start becoming shaky. You can start having high blood pressure. Your pulse can go up. You can start actually going into things they used to make fun of on Bugs Bunny and the like, where you start hallucinating and see pink elephants and the like. You can become psychotic, but certainly your body becomes very shaky, hyper energized, and you can actually have seizures and die from suddenly stopping high doses of alcohol.
So the old theory of just take away the alcohol, lock them in a room, come back 3 days later is not such a good idea because you may find a dead person in that room.
That's right.
The seizures is, and this is all the result of the cortisol going through the roof because it doesn't have the, its balance there from the alcohol.
That's right. That's right. Again, a heavy drinker has heavy cortisol every day. We think because, or I believe, because they go through alcohol withdrawal every day until they have their first drink, you know, 11 hours after they had their last drink, their body is craving alcohol. And unless you're drinking first thing in the morning, you're going through the day becoming more and more uncomfortable. Your cortisol levels are going up, your blood pressure, your pulse, you're becoming irritable, you're becoming a little anxious. And surprise, surprise, that first drink of the day calms you down, partly because you're alleviating the withdrawal effect of that alcohol that you had the night before. But if you just suddenly stop the alcohol, there's no stopping that reaction to the point where you can explode.
There are windows, though. There are windows that I've seen where if you're a heavy drinker and you suddenly have this window where you feel a sense of calm and you say to yourself, I'm not going to drink today. I've seen people suddenly stop with no consequences. Mm-hmm. I've seen people stop eating, stop smoking. I've seen people stop drinking and stop doing drugs. It's almost like there's a little window that presents itself every so often, that if you capitalize on the window, you can stop. Whereas the rest of the time, the reason you stop is because of the consequence of your behavior. So let's say you drank and you got went crazy and you did something really crazy, like you're driving while you're drinking and you get caught by the police, and then you suddenly say, well, I'll stop now. That's where you get the most danger. But I do believe there is a window that everybody gets where a where an addiction can get challenged. You know, challenge meaning like, here's your grace period. Here's an opportunity for you to stop. But we get, it's very hard to recognize those moments.
Right, right. I mean, where you can stop more comfortably. And again, stopping as it relates to the amount of uncomfortableness you feel with withdrawal, as you said, with cigarettes, with alcohol, a very uncomfortable feeling when you suddenly stop something your body has become used to is only the first part of stopping an addiction. But stopping is an essential part of it, you know, but not so easy because it's often very uncomfortable. And with, as it relates to alcohol, it can actually be dangerous to certainly stop suddenly.
So what is your, if you're not in a grace window, which I call it, and you're going to have to take this on, what do you, Kent, the psychiatrist, do to help a person stop drinking instead of having them go cold turkey? What do you do?
Well, again, one way to lower your tolerance and lower your physical addiction to drinking is to drink less every day and to go on a sort of program and a regimen of drinking a few drinks less every day. And
That's hard to do.
That's very hard to do because almost by definition, that would be true with cigarettes as well. And hence, you know, the problem, which is if somebody were able to slow down or moderate, they may have already. But the truth is that, and again, let's even extend it to heroin and OxyContin and painkillers and Vicodin. If you become physically addicted to any of these substances, you can go slowly, take a little bit less every day, and you will find yourself becoming less tolerant over time as you gently readjust the nervous system to lower amounts. Again, that's very hard for the individual to do. Sometimes if you have a friend or somebody who can hold on to the alcohol or hold on to the pills and give you a little less every day, it can actually be a group effort or an effort with somebody else so that you're given a certain amount each day and don't have an ability to find extra. And that can also gently get you less physically addicted to a substance.
Would you say that it's probably advisable to find the lowest stress environment that you could find if you're going to challenge an addiction? It would make sense that you wouldn't try to continue working, that you wouldn't try to continue your daily life, that maybe go sit in a country spot somewhere and just try to chill out in some way if you're going to take this on. What
yeah,
do you think?
Absolutely, because I think that that in and of itself, the sort of discomfort you'll feel as you become less and less tolerant and go through perhaps very mild withdrawal, because there may be very little shortcuts once you become highly addicted to a substance like nicotine, alcohol, cocaine, heroin. There may be, again, slight discomfort as you're going down less each day, and to have added stress from things around you would perhaps be overload. That in fact, the full day job of somebody should probably be being just focused on not taking more of the substance and just trying to keep themselves relaxed and calm as they go through an inevitable uncomfortable period, which should last a few days to a week.
My guest is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, who is a specialist in helping people deal with addictions.
Again, the other way to do this is to get medication from someone like myself. I mean, there, you know, when someone goes inpatient into a hospital or something, they give them medication to have people gently detox from alcohol or other substances. More and more these days, because of health costs and the like, people like myself as an outpatient are able to prescribe medication that does the same thing that they do in a hospital, which is to cause people to gently get off their physical addiction from alcohol over several days and prescribe medication at a decreasing dose over days that has people not have to suddenly go into withdrawal, as we talked about before, with the disastrous effects of the adrenal glands causing cortisol and adrenaline to go through the roof.
So what kind of medication would that be? Tranquilizers or benzos? What would it be?
Yes, it would be a medication that's very similar to alcohol, the same category, which would be something that we call tranquilizers or sedative hypnotics. So we would give a medication like a tranquilizer, benzodiazepam, barbiturates, or something like that, that would cross-react with the alcohol so that your body doesn't need the alcohol and is safer than giving someone alcohol.
And then if a person, well, alcohol people, they have a great deal of problem because they may mix the alcohol with the pills.
That's right.
What do you do in that case?
Well, you know, and that's the real danger, you know, of trying to do this as an outpatient, because these medications will make someone very comfortable during the time that they're not drinking. But if they choose to drink on top of these medications, then that can be very dangerous. That's why sometimes I will enlist the family members or spouses to supervise so that people can't drink on top of it, or actually give a medication, when we're talking about alcohol, give a medication that called antabuse, which is a medication that makes someone violently ill if they drink. So I'll say to somebody, these pills, these Valium, these Klonopin, these tranquilizers will make you very comfortable. And to assure you and me that you're not going to drink on top of these pills and overdose, I will give you a medication that will make you violently ill if you do drink, so that it'll help with some of the cravings you may have to drink. Because even though we're helping you with the withdrawal symptoms, it may be true that you're still going to have cravings for the high and the euphoria of the alcohol.
I don't know of any natural substance that people take that helps in a detoxification. I haven't seen one yet. There's a lot of theory about whether you should eat brown rice or stuff like that. But I think that's for later, cleaning up your diet or while you're doing it. But the thing that helps, what you're saying, is you need some kind of a chemical to help you step down from it.
Right. Right. And again, that's the idea, just to talk about the whole idea of withdrawal, that's the idea that they give Nicorette gum or Nicorette patches for cigarettes. Right. So you don't have to go through abrupt nicotine withdrawal, you know, which is, again, as smokers will
know.
And
we don't have any alcohol patches.
We don't.
Which is kind of surprising.
Right.
You know, it is surprising that there should be, even if it were, they could call it an alcohol patch and they could really do it a tranquilizer, you know?
Right.
But I'm surprised they don't have anything like that.
Yes. I think, again, the medication that I'm able to prescribe are things that work very similar to the nicotine patch in terms of causing the body to become adjusted or addicted to another substance, but another substance that then you can monitor and step down day after day and gently have the nervous system become used to a less and less amount of these heavy tranquilizers.
That seems like it makes the most sense with something like alcohol, but I was also reading, and I wanted you to comment on this, Kent, on the long-range effect of the heavier drugs and what they do to the pleasure centers. Okay, you address that?
Yeah, I think there was an idea that the only reason why people used substances and was to alleviate the withdrawal effect of the substance, meaning the only reason why people did cocaine is because they don't want to experience the discomfort of stopping cocaine abruptly, or the only reason people use narcotics or alcohol or cigarettes for that matter is that they don't want to feel the discomfort of the withdrawal. We know now that all these chemicals of abuse that we have studied, and again, there's millions of chemicals, and yet they're only less than 100 chemicals that human beings and other animals want to use. So there only seems to be a very, very small amount of chemicals that seem to be something that animals, including human beings, seem to want to use. And all these chemicals have in common is that they cause what we know as a pleasure center in the brain, which is a part of the brain that if it's stimulated, sort of goes, yummy, I like that, and I want to do that again. Now, nature probably put that in our brain. We don't know what God or Darwin designed, but we do know that it's probably related to food, seeking comfort, seeking a mate or something. So this pleasure center probably had a very good function. What happens with chemicals like alcohol and cocaine is they powerfully hijack that center of the brain and become a very powerful sort of separate drive or separate force that the brain now overlaps and overtakes all the other pleasures that the person has. And even if you're becoming withdrawn from the substance and no longer in withdrawal, the brain still has powerful memories that go on for days or months or forever of remembering the pleasurable, euphoric feeling that came with those chemicals.
Now, that's quite a statement, the forever statement. It is possible that a person who does cocaine, right, who snorts cocaine or whatever they do with cocaine, and that after a period of time, they lose the ability to replace, to satisfy that same pleasure center. So therefore, they are forever yearning. Are they forever yearning or they're forever depleted?
Well, again, that's a very good distinction to find out, right? Is this something biological where something's happened to the brain permanently that the person no longer has the brain chemistry? And if we're talking about the brain chemistry, we could say what it is. It's dopamine. We know that dopamine is very much involved in this part of the brain that causes pleasure and motivation. So that we do know that if you do a lot of cocaine or amphetamines, that over time there's less dopamine in the brain. Some studies would show that even a year later, the dopamine in the brain is still hasn't returned to normal, and hence may give people a low-level feeling of not having the amount of joy or happiness, a word we use, anhedonia, absence of pleasure, anhedonia. They don't have the same amount of pleasure in life because their dopamine hasn't come back to normal after a fair amount of time.
And one of the interesting things about dopamine is it will be imitated by cortisol. So in other words, when you have a low dopamine level, cortisol very often will raise, give you an illusion that it's raised, but what will happen with cortisol? Rage and anger. So when you see drug addicts who are getting rageful, you're saying to themselves, well, that's the addiction talking. It's part of their withdrawal, and they're trying to raise their dopamine through rage. Right. So it's either rage or take the drug. And one of the things that are common among people who are substance abusers is a lot of rage as the alternative to the chemicals.
Yeah, it seems like that life that some people have, and again, there's some, when we're talking about anhedonia, the absence of pleasure, it's unclear whether some people, even without substance use, genetically or because of their childhood, have less of reactiveness or excitement with life and are then drawn to very intense situations as a way to break through a kind of blah, pleasureless existence. And rage is one way that people excite and energize themselves. Certainly, I've seen another category, which is high-risk behavior, these adrenaline junkies, you know, people who get on skateboards and jump off of cars and off of steps and the like, as a way that some people are desperately trying to cause some energy or excitement because many, many, too many things perhaps cause them to just feel blah, you know, music, friendships, movies, you know, blah.
It's amazing to think of humans at a feeding trough, you know, that we are like pigs at a feeding trough, that we go to the feeding trough because we want to feel, So we'll go to horror movies so that we could have these chemicals released in our brain. And we go, whoopee, whoopee, whoopee. Or we go to pornography so that we could get these chemicals reacted. But it's all like a chemical feeding trough. People think, oh, no, it's about dirty sex. Or, oh, no, you want to be scared. No, you want your brain stimulated. And you're going for the chemicals. And it's like if there is an addiction, it's an addiction to the brain chemicals that we get through what we do on the outside. And it's like it's a funny thing. Humans are just completely prey to it. Overeating, oversexing, overloving is another form of addiction. It's just going to the feeding trough to get all the chemicals that go along with this intense, intense love. You know, so one of the things we're saying is, so what's wrong with that? Why don't you just feed your brain and give yourself all this great pleasure? The trouble is what you're saying. It's like, okay, but then you have a vacuum when you stop because you can't recreate the pleasure center. The pleasure center may be emptied. You may become anhedonic. You may become a person who just sits around blah. So the absence of the addiction is emptiness and nothingness, not health and vitality, which is why there has to be a significant amount of work to balance it on the other side, which I suspect you could get through, healthy eating and exercising, but you got to have friends. You got to have people around. Fascinating conversation. We're going to be continuing this conversation because we're going to be talking more about this. One of the things that I want to talk about, Kent, when we come back, we're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what happens in your office. As in so many medical offices, when patients come in and they have a surreptitious, quiet, hidden idea that all they want from you, the doctor, is the drugs, and they're going to manipulate you into giving them these drugs. Now, this is something that happens to a lot of physicians. And many physicians have to deal with this all the time. The patient is coming in, and you can't trust what the patient has to say. Because the end result of what the patient has to say is they want to get drugs from you to feed the very same system that we're talking about. So when we get back from our break today, we're going to be talking about this with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. And just to reiterate what we have been talking about, we have been talking about addiction, how sudden withdrawal from certain chemicals, especially alcohol, can be dangerous, if not deadly, that some of the other dangers of addiction include the total absence of the pleasure center, which kind of gets worn thin and worn thin in such a way that you don't know how to feel pleasure anymore. And it's a very difficult, difficult existence. So even though for many people, addiction may be the only pleasure around, it's like, it's quite a choice, quite a choice. And as much as possible, we always want to help people who get caught in that kind of thing, you know, whatever we can do. And I'm sure that that's most of your life, Kent, right? Most of the treatments you do.
Yeah, most of the people are trying to figure out how to live their lives without this addictive, pleasurable, yet destructive, as you mentioned, gambling, love, sex, drugs. Ultimately, it's not a moral issue. These things become destructive. They become pained by their addiction. And yet, when they give up the addiction, they're trying to find, how do I find happiness and joy without this behavior, which for so many years was the major reason I would look forward to the weekend, let's say.
When we get back, my friends, we're going to be talking more about this. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little music, and we'll continue. New York. from a little while back. Bud Freeman and Eddie Condon. Amazing. Just to wake you up a little bit. Because I'm addicted to music. You know what I mean? Take away music and there's a big vacuum in my life, Kent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a source of pleasure that, again, for me, as you know, is daily joy, euphoria, as much now as when I was 15 years old. And so it's a beautiful thing, hopefully.
But the nice thing about music is you don't have to keep increasing the amount.
That's right.
What I mean? Just give me something really good. But there are two other things we didn't talk about. And one is the need to travel. People and their dissatisfaction with where they are.
Well, again, I think that, you know, traveling's wonderful and a wonderful way to add something to your life. But I find a lot of people, it really underscores just a low-level, blah, lack of joy in their lives, that their whole years are really revolving around looking forward to traveling. And there seems to be, you know, a lack of both day-to-day, but obviously a lot of people, when they work, they're stressed out, they come home, they unwind. But you would think the weekend could be a place where everybody has an opportunity to just find their joy and bliss. And I think for a lot of people, weekends become just blah, drudgery, housework, bills, or just blah. And the only thing that's really giving them joy is a vacation. And they're not really getting the week-to-week joys or bliss or happiness that other people are able to find with their friends, with love, with music, and other hobbies and interests and passions.
So for some people, travel could be a form of addiction.
Yeah.
Because you're looking to stimulate your brain, and you're looking to stimulate those senses because you're trying to find something to make me feel.
Right.
Make me feel. I know other people who do it with shopping. And now, with internet shopping, there are levels of compulsions where people go online, they just have to buy something every day. And, you know, for a while back, it started to appear when TV marketing first appeared. You know, when they had those shows where you'd buy jewelry on television. When they first appeared, they unleashed this kind of addiction, the shopping addiction, the home shopping addiction. Now we don't even see it. But, you know, people on Amazon and people who are just out there, I must buy something today.
Oh,
I must. And it's going to be bigger numbers than we've ever seen.
Yeah, there's absolutely, again, when we're talking about, again, why are these addictions painful for people is because drugs and sex and spending and shopping causes a lot of pain in people's life when their addiction becomes so out of control, or it pushes away their ability to find pleasure and joy with other, you know, means in their life. But certainly shopping, you know, the credit debt crunch in this country is partly related to people, I believe, who feel blah, listless, unhappy in their weekends. And then all of a sudden when they say, oh, I'll go buy something, all of a sudden they get energized, their dopamine levels go up. And it's not even important what they buy, just the fact that I'm going to touch money, spend money, and walk away with something in my hand gives people a sense of anticipation and joy. And it keeps them, you know, from feeling just listless and blah and sort of low level anhedonic all weekend long.
There are many people who have unopened boxes of things that they've bought all over their house because the thrill was in the buying.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so let's talk about this now. Look, Doc, somebody comes to you and they say to you, they start having practiced, they have prepared to come to you, to talk to you so that they could get medication. And let's say they come into you and they complain about migraine, you know, and that's it. I've got to go to my psychiatrist and talk about migraine. And their end desire is to get Demerol. They know this.
Right.
So the manipulation is to get Demerol from the doc. Now, they may not have migraine, but they could describe enough symptoms that if they do it right, they're going to get the drug from you, aren't they?
They are. They're going to, you know, again, doctors are in a very difficult position that we don't read minds, and we don't know who walking in our office has overwhelming pain, overwhelming anxiety, overwhelming difficulties, focus, and concentrating. And those who have learned how to exaggerate or outright fabricate and make up those symptoms, knowing that the treatment of those three things I just mentioned, pain, anxiety, and inability to concentrate, are medications which can help those things, but are also in those 100 chemicals I talked about in the first half of the show, which cause the pleasure center in the brain to go, yummy, I like that, I'd like that again. That's exactly what those chemicals do. So the physician is in a very damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, because we don't know who's legit and who's not.
Well, how do you know? How are you damned if you don't? So the person walks in and they say, I've got this excruciating pain in my head. I can't get rid of the pain. Give me Demerol. Right? And you say, no, I don't want to give you Demerol. I don't like prescribing Demerol. I don't like the drug. I'm not going to prescribe it. I'll give you aspirin with codeine. I mean, isn't that what the doctor does?
Well, often that's exactly what they do. I mean, again, even though I'm somebody who goes on and on about addiction, the other side of the problem, the opposite side of the problem, is often doctors underprescribe appropriate medication to help people who are truly suffering from pain or anxiety. But here you're talking about migraine pain. They underprescribe medication to alleviate pain with people who are not manipulators, who are not drug addicts, who are just suffering from a medical disorder causing pain. And we doctors obviously have medication that can alleviate pain.
So how do you know?
You don't know.
You go on, so you kind of lean toward the side of, if you fool me enough, I'll give you a prescription.
Yeah, I think I think the route that I take, I guess everyone's an individual, is trying to give people the benefit of the doubt and to trust people until proven otherwise. So, I guess it's Ronald Reagan, though I didn't believe in his politics so much, but trust with verification, meaning that I think as a physician, you know, as our role is to alleviate suffering, is we should try to err in terms of hoping that the person and most people are honest and are legitimately coming to you with suffering and you can alleviate the suffering. And then over time, if something should come up that should raise suspicions, then to be more questioning and distrusting.
So what about OxyContin, for example? Now, OxyContin is one of the most available misused prescription drugs, right? And it's something that, you know, people use for pleasure as well as people use for pain.
Right.
If a person comes to you, well, you're not a physical doctor since you are a psychiatrist. They're not going to come to you with back pain so much, are they?
A little bit. Actually, over the years, because of my interest in addiction, interest in pain. So, yes, sometimes they do.
So if they come to you with back pain and they say, I'd like some OxyContin, you know, that's what helps it. What do? You give them a little bit?
If they have a history that suggests that they've done a lot of the kind of treatments that help chronic back pain and it hasn't helped, I would say that maybe they need to be in something a little bit stronger, because if they're suffering from back pain, certainly I may not jump to something as strong as OxyContin and from aspirin or M&Ms. I may try something a little bit, Tylenol with codeine or the like, but it would certainly suggest that you may want to give somebody something to alleviate their suffering.
From your point, from where you are. And I know there are doctors who would refuse to write a prescription, and they could be neglectful as well.
Yeah, there's a very interesting study about doctors that, again, they sort of know how much pain that medical symptoms cause, meaning that there was a famous study done where doctors were asked if you or a loved one had an impacted wisdom tooth or had a kidney stone or had a gallbladder attack or pancreatitis, something like that, that what would you give them? And all doctors would say, oh, well, I give them codeine or something more severe, or OxyContin, something more powerful. Then the researchers, 6 months to a year later, then asked the person, oh, somebody comes in off the street and says they have the identical pain syndrome that they were asked 6 months before. What would you give them? And many doctors would say, you know, take two aspirin and call me in the morning, meaning this study suggests that doctors know how much pain something should cause. And when it's for themselves or a loved one, someone they trust, they will give appropriate amount of pain meds. But to strangers, maybe there's an over-concern about addiction and manipulation, whereas statistically, probably 96% of people, over, you know, less than 5% of people manipulate and misuse these chemicals. The vast majority of people just want to ease their suffering.
Well, you know, what I love about you, Ken, is you're being such an honest doctor, and I appreciate it. How much of what you do is guided by your fear of being sued?
You know, a large percentage of doctors' lives, unfortunately, is determined by fear of lawsuits. There's no, in America, I'll get into a little tangent, you know, in America, there's so many more malpractice suits than the rest of the world. So that when, you know, people complain about doctors over-prescribing, over-testing and the like, I always say the one little caveat is that lots of them are just very wary about not writing a lot of tests or ordering a lot of tests or giving medication because of the fear of being sued. That isn't true in other countries, and that's why they perhaps don't overtreat the way they do in America. It's not just because we want to make money, though that may be true with some doctors, but it's also a fear that if you don't overdiagnose and overtreat, you run the risk of getting sued.
So you would have to treat a good friend of yours who you knew would never hurt you, right? You would give them a different treatment than you would give somebody who you knew could potentially harm you.
Yeah.
Even though you might have the same suggestion, you'd have to be wary because you'd say, you know, but this person is dangerous to me. And all people are dangerous. It's not a good friend. I have to consider everybody could in some way be harmful to me, even if my intentions are perfect.
Right, right. And again, I think when you're... Again, where I said before with medication, damned if you do, damned if you don't, because obviously, whether it's Michael Jackson or Heath Ledger or Rush Limbaugh, you know, again, there's lots and lots of famous celebrity overdoses in the last year where they weren't heroin addicts and they weren't coke addicts. They misused and overused and died. In the Michael Jackson Heath Ledger case, with prescription medications written by doctors. And so that there, you know, definitely is out there a fair amount of people, Heath Ledger and Michael Jackson, just the tip of the iceberg of people who misuse, go to doctors and get excessive amount of medication in order to feed their addiction, not to alleviate any medical problem.
Well, you know, in addition to that, doctors, so many people fear the doctors and they think the doctors don't know what they're doing, which is probably accurate. So people become their own doctors.
Right, right.
And in their cases, what they're doing is taking medications that they may be mixing,
right.
Things that they may be taking together they don't understand may not work for them. So in many ways, people are getting their own pills,
right.
Storing them up, you know, saving them and doing right. Their own medications because of the distrust of the physician and the distrust of the physician's fear of liability.
Right.
You know, since the physician fears the liability... Right. Then they know the doctor can't tell the truth and they know the doctor may be prescribing something because he's on a trial or some way. And so they have to say, be your own doctor, which most people are doing.
Right.
And most people are saying, be your own physician, take your own medication, so on and so forth, or stay away from medication completely, which is the other attitude. And they're trying their very best because doctors are not trustworthy, not that you're not trustworthy, but you can't trust your doctor because the main thing about him is he's afraid of getting sued. That's first. As I saw a physician once when I saw somebody get hit by a car And I knew there was a physician there, and I said, why don't you help? And he said, I can't. My insurance won't let me do it.
Right.
You know? So we have quite a remarkable system here of people who are trying to find a way to balance their medical knowledge with medical information, with medical people. And there are a few good guys out there. I think you're a good guy. I think there are a few good. Majid Ali is a good guy. I think there are good guys out there with very good intention. But the way the system is now, it doesn't work very easily. It's very difficult for everybody, the sick as well as the healers.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're talking about pain syndromes, again, there's really two categories. There's migraine, which hopefully is just a couple of days or a day a week or a month, as you mentioned, or again, as I said, appendicitis, or I have an impacted wisdom tooth or the like. And then there's the whole other category of chronic pain, which again is where a lot of medications and a lot of pain medications are prescribed. Now, the first part of the show, we talked about tolerance. We talk about the nature of these chemicals is, yes, they're very yummy, but over time, that your body becomes tolerant to them. So I think there is a healthy danger, and where I come down in terms of chronic pain is you're often in a dangerous place when you're moving into the category of opiates, which are pain medications like codeine, OxyContin, because the truth is your body becomes physically addicted to it, it becomes tolerant to it, and over time with chronic pain, pain medications stop working. And the only way to get them to start working again is to increase the dose. So the tolerance and withdrawal, all the things we talked about, alcohol, the first part of the show, is also true about pain medication with people with chronic pain. So it's a very hard decision about whether to give narcotics or pain meds with chronic pain with a 47-year-old with a back problem who may live to 107. So then you're saying you got to be on pain meds for 60 years, maybe at ever increasing higher and higher doses.
What fibromyalgia is an area that fascinates you, isn't it?
Yes, it's
Can you talk a little about it?
It's a very complicated area that I don't quite understand what fibromyalgia exactly is, but it seems to be a cluster of symptoms that people have with all body pain, fatigue, joint pain, muscle tension, and the like. And people's lives are miserable day after day with a feeling of fatigue and chronic full body pain. And it's true that a narcotic will ease the pain that someone has with fibromyalgia. But it's very unclear what is fibromyalgia. Certainly, you know, as a psychiatrist, there are many medications that are not addictive or abusable. And I think even Cymbalta, an antidepressant, is now being marketed as a treatment of fibromyalgia. There are many medications that seem to help the chronic pain syndromes.
Well, how do you account for the chronic pain syndrome if Cymbalta works for it? Cymbalta is working on serotonin levels.
Right.
And so how would that affect the chronic pain?
Well, because we actually now know that a lot of pain isn't necessarily in the tissue that is causing the pain, meaning that a lot of pain is not just your back or your neck. A lot of pain also gets processed. All those pain fibers get processed in the brain. And what we do know is people can either amplify pain syndromes and make pain more severe, and other people are able to de-amplify pain syndromes. So that there are people out there where you look at them, and I see they have horrible arthritis, and their hands, you know, have rheumatoid arthritis, and yet they don't take any pain medication, and they are in low-level pain, but somehow they're able to function and not be on any medication at all. Somehow they're able to de-amplify or to sort of minimize those pain syndromes, signals. And other people, it seems for reasons that we don't quite understand, they amplify those pain signals in the brain. And we'd know that antidepressants that affect brain chemistry as you mentioned, serotonin, norepinephrine, those brain chemistries actually help with the brain processing of brain signals to alleviate the what happens in the brain.
Well, wouldn't you think that part of the treatment that you as a physician have to offer is to help people tolerate small amounts of pain instead of always trying to get rid of it? Wouldn't you think that there's a point at which you start saying to people, it's okay that it hurts. It hurts because it's a little broken. Live with it rather than get rid of the pain. Do you think people should just automatically medicate and be pain-free? Or do you think people should learn to tolerate a little pain? Because as you get older, there's going to be more and more of it. And if there is going to be more of it and you're okay with dealing with pain, you're not going to be so medication dependent.
That's right. I mean, absolutely. It's, you know, between a rock and a hard place, right? You're either going to be hooked on medication that could be lose effectiveness over time, and you're going to need a higher and higher dose because of tolerance. Or, as you're saying, you have to live and hopefully thrive, not just survive, but thrive despite having a low-level sensation of pain. That, again, because there's no medication or few medications that can totally get rid of the pain without consequences, like the narcotics, the pain medications we describe, that really that's the only alternative, is to sort of say to people, you have to learn to live with this pain syndrome and hopefully not let the anxiety and the depression about the pain interfere with your day-to-day life.
Hey, my guest, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, R-O-B-E-R-T-S-H-A-W. You can get to Kent through my website, thepositivemind.com. Thank you very much, Kent, once again. Exciting, wonderful.
Jazzy.
You're a good guy.
Thanks. Thanks. Good to be here. Gotcha.